I'm Mark Steiner. We're about to have a conversation about the story of stuff with Annie Leonard. And Annie Leonard, welcome. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
The story of stuff. So before we launch into what I think about your website and this work, tell us about the story of stuff and what you did and how you started this.
Well, I literally spent 20 years traveling around the world visiting hundreds of factories where our stuff is made and dumps where our stuff is dumped. I did it partly with various jobs with environmental organizations and partly because I just became a little obsessed with where all our stuff comes from and where it goes. And I summarized all the things that I found about the environment, about social justice, about public health, about the impacts on communities here and abroad. I summarized all this in a 20-minute, fast-paced, fact-filled little film called The Story of Stuff that's available up on the Internet.
Now, The Story of Stuff, I mean, if this is a kind of a pencil-drawing cartoon, right?
Yeah, it sounds rather boring, I have to
but
say.
It's not.
It's just me standing in front of a whiteboard with some stick figures explaining how the global material economy works.
And in doing that, I mean, you set up this whole thing behind you, extraction, production, distribution, consumption, disposal, another way. But the amazing part of the story you've done is that it's now been seen in thousands of schools across the country to use this to create a discussion among their students.
Oh, more than thousands. I have to tell you, the response to the film has just floored me. I just didn't know there were that many people who shared my interest in how materials move through the economy. But we launched the film free online in December 2007. And according to Google Analytics, it has now been viewed over 7.6 million times by people in over 200 countries and territories. Plus, we have been inundated with requests for the DVD from churches, from community groups, and from schools, ranging literally from elementary schools all the way to Oxford economics postgraduate classes. It's being used in schools and universities all over the world.
You had no idea this was going to happen when you made this little 20-minute film, did you?
I had no idea. In fact, at one point while we were making the film, I do have the word "you suck" in there. And I remember somebody said, "You should take out 'you suck' because then it won't be allowed to be shown in schools." And I said, "Are you nuts? This isn't going to be shown in schools." So I was wrong.
And does the word stay in?
Yeah, the word stayed in. I didn't take out anything in order to appease anybody, and that was a great lesson because one of the things I learned is that I think environmentalists and social change activists too often are tempted to tone down our message so as not to alienate people, and I didn't think anyone was going to watch it, so I didn't tone it down at all, and it turns out that, you know, speaking the truth really resonates with people.
So when you made this, you were still with Greenpeace, right?
No, I left Greenpeace about a decade ago, but I did draw very much on my incredible decade working with Greenpeace all over the world.
So let's talk a bit about, for our listeners here who have not seen it, you can go, as you're hearing this or looking at this, you can go to the our website, and there'll be a link to Story of Stuff, or go right to Story of Stuff on the web and see what we're talking about. But talk about the Story of Stuff. Talk about just very briefly what this movie shows us in extraction, production, distribution, consumption, disposal, because you hit it in a very simplistic way, but in a very powerful way. I mean, it's just an amazing short piece.
Sure. Well, one of the things I realized in all my travel is that most of the life of all the consumer products that we have in our day-to-day life, most of the life of this stuff is hidden from our view. We only know these products between the store, our house, and then the garbage can, which is an increasingly short time span. And so I wanted to show people where all this stuff comes from, all the effort that's taken to recover the materials, to make the stuff, to ship it around the world, you know, all the effort that it takes to move these things around. So the film starts with extraction, where we get the metals and the water and the minerals and the oil and the coal from the, you know, the other natural resources from the earth that we use for ingredients or for power to make all our stuff. Goes from extraction to production, where we mix in toxic chemicals and use lots of energy to turn these natural resources into products, to distribution, where we ship all this crap all over the world to keep buying and selling it as fast as possible, to consumption, where we bring it into our homes, to disposal, where we put it out the back door, usually in a dump or an incinerator or maybe into a recycling program. So it runs through extraction, production, distribution, consumption, and disposal, which altogether I call the materials economy.
Now, people have said that your approach to this, and there's some of the complaints about it from some of the school districts and some parents, that your approach to this is anti-capitalist.
Yeah, that really surprised me when they first started saying that, because when I made this film, critiquing capitalism was nowhere, literally nowhere on my radar screen. What I wanted to do was show people, get people to start thinking about where all their stuff comes from and where it goes. It was as simple as that. I wanted to talk about systems of production and consumption. And in doing so, I talked about a system that we've developed that prioritizes profit over public health, that values people based on how much money they have and how much money they spend, that allows toxic chemicals to be used in consumer products so pervasively that they're now showing up in every human body tested, even in amniotic fluid and breast milk. You know, I described what I saw, and when these critics came back to me and said, that's anti-capitalist, I said, let's look into that. So are they saying that capitalism is a system that allows unborn babies to be contaminated with toxic chemicals, that capitalism is a system that prioritizes corporate profits over public health? If that's what they're saying, then I have to say, I guess they're right. Capitalism's not working, and I'm glad they pointed that out so we can talk about it.
Well, when you said that's not what you thought about when you began this story of stuff, I'm curious, it sounds in some ways as if your analysis and your understanding of this has grown along with the expansion of the story of stuff in some ways.
That's interesting. It definitely has. I knew, of course, that our economic system definitely drives this problem, absolutely. So it wasn't that I hadn't thought about it, but it wasn't my goal in making the film. My goal in making the film was just to get people to start thinking about where our stuff comes from and where it goes. That was my immediate goal. And what I realized is people are ready for that conversation and ready for the next step, which is saying, why? Why do we have a system that's based on fossil fuels that are wrecking the climate? Why do we have a system that's based on this one-way flow of resources? People are ready to ask why, and it turns out that our economic system is a big one of those drivers, and so people are ready for that conversation.
Well, let me read a quote that comes out of your film. In some ways, it's almost the centerpiece of what's happened to us, and I want to go backwards and forwards around these ideas, maybe take it to where what we might be able to do about all of this. But you have a quote, and I'll read it, and it's Victor Lebo, and the quote is, "Our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life, that we convert the buying and pursuit of goods into rituals, that we seek our spiritual satisfaction, our ego satisfaction, in consumption. We need things consumed, burned up, replaced, and discarded at an ever-accelerating rate."
Yeah, that's pretty clear, huh? Victor Lebeau articulated what was happening pretty clearly. I think that's a really powerful quote, because it's so true. And this consumer-based society we have that is just based on the ever-increasing flow of goods, and even more importantly, the smushing together of our sense of self-worth with the things that we own, the fact that we're trying to soothe our ego and feed our self-esteem through buying stuff, the fact that those things have become so normalized, we forget about them. It's almost like it's invisible to us. It's become so much a part of what society's about. And one of the things I love about that quote is he's just calling it out. Our society has absolutely become too focused on consumption. It's hurting the planet. It's hurting public health. And it's even undermining our very communities and well-being here at home, not just overseas.
But you're arguing that planned obsolescence of things and perceived obsolescence of the things we have is not something that just happened by happenstance.
Absolutely. Some of the people say that, or some of the viewers that have watched the story of stuff has criticized it, saying I'm too negative about corporations. And I want to be really clear. I don't think that every bad thing a corporation has done has been totally intentional and manipulative, but pursuing planned obsolescence and perceived obsolescence absolutely has. Planned obsolescence is another word for design for the dump. It refers to when producers make stuff that is designed to be thrown away, to break, to be not upgradable, to be useless as quickly as possible. Perceived obsolescence is when those same companies convince us that something needs to be thrown away, even if it's still perfectly good, like it goes out of fashion or it's no longer trendy. Now, promoting planned obsolescence and perceived obsolescence is absolutely intentional, is absolutely manipulative, and I think is just totally evil. But these companies are doing it, and they're doing it because the economic system we have relies on continued production and consumption, but we all have enough stuff. We are stuff saturated in this country. So the only way to keep us buying more and more and more of this crap is to make us keep throwing it away, either by making it break quickly or by making it, you know, fashionably undesirable.
I mean, the one little piece of this story of stuff that you talk about, our computers, and I mean, I wasn't aware of that, and how real that was. The idea that we buy these new computers for thousands of dollars every couple of years because our computers are no longer useful because they've been raised exponentially to the next level. But you're saying there's one little chip?
It's not just one little chip. It's bigger than a little chip. It's actually a little bit bigger than it looks in that drawing. But there is one part of the computer that is the part that gets obsolete. The rest of the computer still works. Think of all the computers that you've run through in your life. Likely the monitor, the casing, the keyboard, the fans. Likely, you know, a big percentage of the actual material in that computer was still perfectly useful when you had to check it out, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why not make computers modular? Why not make it so that that piece that does get upgraded, often for very real technical reasons, and that's good. If it's a real technical progress, that's great. But why not make it so that that part can snap in and out? Why do we have to throw away the whole casing and the keyboard and the whole thing? Also, why are we still allowing computer companies to put all these toxic chemicals in our electronics? In Europe, they have some European-wide directives now that are saying producers of electronics have to get toxic heavy metals like lead, cadmium, mercury, and some of these flame retardants out of computers. Why are we still allowing these companies to produce this stuff here? These companies are constantly focusing their effort on making stuff quicker, faster, sleeker, cuter. Why not have them put that same kind of intelligence and, you know, design innovation into making this stuff less toxic, more durable, more upgradable? It's all part of that planned and perceived obsolescence.
But you're talking about, in some ways, to do that, change the entire nature of what the corporate marketplace is emanating from America.
Well, you know what? I hate to tell you this, but we have to change. Some people ask me, are we going to change? And I say, we are definitely going to change. The question is, are we going to change by design or by default? Right now, globally, we're using 1.4 planets worth of resources every year. If every country lived like the United States, we'd be using 5 planets. But globally, even with all those inequities, we're using 1.4 planets worth of resources. You can't keep using 1.4 planets indefinitely when you only have one planet. We are bumping up against the wall. So change is inevitable. The question is it going to be by design or by default? And if we change by design, it's going to be hard work. It's going to really require some changes in the way that we run our society. But at least we can be more compassionate and intelligent and intentional about it. If we dig our heels in and absolutely refuse to budge, if we, as Dick Cheney and George Bush said, if we say the American way of life is non-negotiable, if we refuse to look at how we're using materials and figure out how to use less, then we're still going to have to change because we're still bumping up against planetary limits, but it's going to be a lot uglier, a lot more violent.
There's some things that pop out, at least popped out at me inside of your 20-minute video presentation story of stuff that were really chilling. One was very chilling. And when you talk about, I think it's doing extraction. I think that's when took place. When you talk about the synthetic, 100,000 synthetic chemicals that we use and how it affects breastfeeding. And
yeah.
Talk a bit about that, because, I mean, that's something that some people go, hey, are my kids going to see this? You know, but it was a very chilling moment.
Yeah, there's a lot of really stark facts in the story of stuff, and I do run through it really fast. So one thing I want to point your viewers and listeners and readers to is that there is a footnoted script on the website, too, where people can look up more information about all these facts. So in the story of stuff, one of the things that I talk about is the use of persistent pollutants in our industrial processes. We use now about 100,000 synthetic chemicals in our industrial processes on a day-to-day basis. None of them have been fully tested for health impacts in relationship with all the other chemicals that we use. So it's really like a giant chemical experiment that we're conducting right now on the public. Now, a lot of these chemicals are bioaccumulative. That means they are fat-soluble and they build up the food chain. So if a little fish eats some pieces, and then a medium-sized fish eats that little fish, and then a big fish eats it. And as it goes up the food chain, the animals get higher and higher levels of these pollutants. And so, tragically, the food that is at the top of the food chain is human breast milk. And that means that humans have often the highest level of these toxic contaminants. Men have no way of getting rid of these toxic contaminants, but women do, which is breastfeeding. And so terribly, we are passing on our lifetime accumulation of toxic chemicals onto our newborn babies. Now, absolutely, mothers should still breastfeed. Breastfeeding has so many emotional and health benefits, and we should definitely breastfeed it. But we should be protecting breastfeeding. And, you know, it's not just in breastfeeding that the little ones are getting bombarded. The Environmental Working Group did a study of umbilical cords of newborn babies and found an average of 287 industrial chemicals in the umbilical cords of newborn babies. So we have allowed this toxic pollution to become so pervasive that it's even getting the youngest brand new members of our society. And I keep thinking, isn't that the point where we draw a line in the sand and say, enough, get your toxic chemicals out of my breast milk, out of my amniotic fluid, enough, they've got to stop.
I'm going to come back to the stop part in a second, but it made me think that one of the things that we're doing to ourselves here, it's being done to us and to ourselves, is that we're polluting all of our fluids, amniotic fluid, breast milk, blood, the water around us. That all that liquid is our life, and we're destroying it all.
Absolutely. Somehow people have gotten so disconnected from nature that people sometimes think, like, we can contaminate the water, but it won't get us. We can contaminate these other animals, but it won't get us. Like, we are so integrally connected to nature that what we put into the environment, it's putting it into us.
So when you talk about in the story of stuff about that we all use in America, four and a half pounds of garbage a day is what we create. That's amazing. And then everybody talks about recycling, but then you attack recycling as not inadequate to answer the question. So if recycling is inadequate, you can tell us why you think that. Then what is the way to address this issue?
Well, I think that recycling is a piece of the solution. Definitely when we use materials which should be non-toxic and more durable so that we're decreasing the toxicity and decreasing the overall volume of what we're using, we definitely need to have recycling. It plays an important role in a healthy materials economy. But there's a reason that recycling comes in last in that often repeated mantra of reduce, reuse, recycle. Recycling is the last thing we should do with something. Recycling is what you do when your back is against the wall and there was absolutely no way that you could have avoided the use of that product, that you could have shared it with other people so you didn't need to throw it away so fast, that you could have designed it out of use. You know, recycling is in many ways an admission of defeat. It's like, all right, you know, I give up, I'll recycle it. It's not the first thing we should do. Too often people rush to throw the stuff in the blue bin and feel so good and say, I'm an environmentalist now. And it's actually led me to say that recycling is the opiate of the masses. It's encouraging us to keep consuming and keep throwing away because as long as we put it in the blue bin instead of that gray box, we feel like it's perfectly fine to continue this unsustainable level of consumption.
But if your argument is correct, that this idea of consumerism and planned obsolescence is in fact a thoughtfully created policy in America that's changed the way we look at what we do, what we buy, what we eat, what we consume. But it's been around for 60 years now. We've been developing this or more in a major way. Then it becomes a way of life, just like automobiles are a way of life in America. And changing that is the question. I mean, changing the idea that people don't want to consume, don't want to buy a new computer of year, don't want to buy a new pair of shoes, this pair of pants because they look this kind of shirt because it's what will attract the women or attract the men or whatever that is you're wearing. I mean, that's part of what we've been enculturated with now.
That's true, but we have two really big motivators for change here. One is that we're bumping up against the planet's limits, so we can't continue. So as I said before, change is inevitable. Like, we can't, continuing is just simply not an option unless we want to, like, run the planet down into flames. The other big motivator that we have on our side, which is really lucky for us, is that the current system isn't making people happy. It's just not working. The way that we're extracting, producing, distributing, using, and throwing away stuff right now, there's three problems with it. We're trashing the planet, we're trashing each other, and we're not even having fun. Now, that not having fun part is really key, because if we were really having fun, if the vast majority of the people on the planet were happy and healthy and it was like a really good party, we might say, okay, let's just trash the planet. Let's just go down in flames, but it's going to be a really good ride. But the bottom line is that most people aren't having fun. More people than ever, we've just passed the billion people mark, more people than ever are going to bed hungry every single night. Income inequality is increasing. Even in the rich countries, we have rising levels of diabetes, obesity, heart problems, stress, anxiety. People are socially isolated now. Half of the people in the United States say they don't know their neighbors' names. A quarter of the people in the U.S. say they don't have a friend to talk to when they are feeling blue or having personal troubles. Socially, health-wise, environmentally, in every way, it's just not working. And so the fact that it's not fun provides a great opening to let's just try something different. And if you look at the evolving science of happiness and what really brings people happiness, it's not the new pair of designer jeans or the flat-screen TV. Study after study shows that what really brings happiness is the quality of one's social relationships. It's coming together with others around a shared goal. It's having a sense of purpose beyond yourself. All of these things are what we're going to get more of as we unplug from this consumer mania, this take-make-waste lifestyle. As we unplug from that and replug into vibrant, healthy communities, we're actually going to have more fun.
And one of the things you say in this short film is that we have more stuff, but our happiness has gone down, and we have less leisure time now than since medieval times.
Right, we have less leisure time now than we did in feudal society. It's interesting to look at trajectories of leisure time with Europe and the United States. Both in Europe and the United States, there were, of course, huge increases in productivity during the Industrial Revolution. And the United States and Europe took different paths after this. The United States decided to trade their increases in productivity for more stuff. So we work harder than we did in feudal societies. We work harder, longer hours than any other industrialized country except perhaps South Korea. We work like dogs in this country. Lots of people don't even have any vacation the entire year. Half the country has 1 week or less of vacation a year. We are working like mad, but we have gigantic houses and gigantic cars and gigantic televisions and more stuff. Whereas Europe took a different path. They took a more sort of socially oriented path where they decided to trade a lot of those gains in productivity for more social goods. They have smaller houses, smaller cars, smaller refrigerators. I don't know, for people who visited Europe, you know, all our friends over there have those racks that they hang on the doorways to dry their clothes. They just have less appliances, less stuff. It's smaller, but they have 2 months of vacation and paid maternity leave, and they don't have to stress out about their health care and how to pay for colleges. They took what I think is a much more civilized route, more social goods, less stuff, more leisure. We took continued working like dogs, but we have lots and lots of stuff to show for it.
Do you work like a dog, Annie Leonard?
I do. Isn't that ironic? But you know what? I do it out of passion and love, not out of buying more stuff.
Do you take vacations?
Not enough, but I do. But you know, for me, vacation's going to visit some dump in another country. I'm not a good role model on the not working too hard.
But it's amazing.
I do think there's a difference if you're working so hard, because it just absolutely turns you on and is a source of joy rather than if you're
trying to
pay for the new Pottery Barn couch.
But it is something in the American socially structured DNA that we all do that.
Right. We even scorn people who take long vacations.
Right. Right. Exactly. You know, I mean, it's just, and my preach the same stuff, but I feel like I don't live what I preach sometimes.
You know, we got to reclaim that sense of community, that sense of leisure. I was in Turkey last year for a meeting, and all the Turkish activists, who are really good activists, they hang out at cafes and talk. And I told them, we don't do that in the United States. And they said, why not? And I was trying to think. I was like, well, we're too busy.
Right.
But you know what? They're having way more fun. We need to do that. We need to work smarter, not harder.
I think so. I mean, so I wonder, now you have this story of stuff, this incredible 20-minute film that's taken places by storm. It says 7.6 million viewers on your website, schools that have been watching it across the globe. I went on your website this morning. You had this website translated into 11 foreign languages.
Even more on YouTube, that people got tired of waiting for us and just did it themselves.
So this story of stuff is having some effect on people's conversations, on what people think about things, which is what you wanted to have happen.
Absolutely. My goal in making the film was literally to turn the volume up on the discussion about where our stuff comes from, where it goes, and what the problems with the system is. Now, that absolutely has worked. I feel like it was a thriving success. I remember when we made the film, we were guessing that success would be 50,000 views. I think we got that in about 4 hours. So we have, it's been an enormous success. But turning up the volume on discussion is only the first step. Now we need to turn the volume up on activism. So we're actually doing the next step now is we've launched a little project, the Story of Stuff Project, to harness all of this energy. You know, at first I thought I was just making a film. I didn't know that people were going to then want to do stuff. But I have been flooded with literally tens of thousands of emails from people who say, I want to get involved. And at first I was like, get involved in what? It's a cartoon. But then I thought, geez, if everybody wants to get involved, let's get going. So we started a little nonprofit organization. We're revamping the website so that it's much more activist-oriented and can plug people into work. We're working with some wonderful groups to make a study and action guide for two communities that have been especially interested in the film. For educators, we're working with Facing the Future in Seattle to make a teacher's guide for educators in middle and high schools that want to use the film and then build whole curriculums around that. And we're also working with Green Faith to develop a study and action guide for faith-based communities because the film has had enormous resonance in faith-based communities. And in both cases, the idea is to guide people through discussion and critical thinking, but then help people figure out where they can plug in to actually make a difference. We want to, in effect, turn the movie into a movement.
That's amazing. So I noticed that on your website, one of the places on your website says this is what you can do. And when I read that, they seem like had more to do with something you don't poo-poo, but that you don't seem as think is important, which is personal responsibility, and as opposed to kind of social action. But now you're saying social action is the key to this.
Right. You know, I really am critical of those lists of the 10 simple things you can
yes.
do to save the planet.
Right.
Because what we need is not simple. I actually saw a book recently. It says, How to Save the Planet Without Ever Leaving Your Desk. And I thought, that's dumb. The first thing you should do is leave your desk. Like, you know, we really need to get away from this sort of seeking out 10 simple things that we can do
right.
during our lunch break to save the planet, because the changes we need are much deeper than that. So I have resisted making lists of 10 simple things you could do, although people ask me for this constantly. So I did make that one list that's on the website, but it's sort of tongue-in-cheek because it says, yes, you should change your light bulb, but then you should change your paradigm. Yes, you should recycle your waste, but then you should recycle your elected officials. Yes, you should park your bike and walk, and when necessary, march in the streets. Because, of course, these individual actions are good, and of course we should be responsible in our life. But those kinds of things, recycling, changing the light bulb, carrying your own bag and bottle, those kind of things are not political acts. Those are like, you know, grown-up hygiene. Those are like running a responsible household and body. Those things we should just do as a matter of course. It's like flossing your teeth. Do them, but we don't need to keep patting each other on the back after some point about that. What we really need to do to make change is to come together with others and engage in the political process and be a citizen, not just a consumer.
I mean, I think that one of the things, what you're trying to do in this film as well, and this discussion you want to have, is making the connection, connecting the dots between what we consume and have and how that affects life around the globe. I mean, whether you're talking about the building of our computers and the stuff that goes in those computers and the connection to people in the Congo and around the world who will mine the coltrane that goes in the computers that we never think about are our cell phones, and the oppression that goes with that, and the destruction of the planet that goes with that. These are connections you don't make very readily.
Absolutely. That was one of my big goals, is to make those connections, partly just to get people thinking more about where this stuff comes from, but also to talk to my fellow activists in the progressive movement. I feel like we retard our ability to make fundamental change by staying in our silos. There are forest activists and recycling activists and energy activists and gender rights activists and, you know, fair trade activists. And the more that we stay in our silos, the less we can understand the sort of systemic nature of these problems and move from what I call transactional politics to a transformative politics. So one of my real goals in making this film was to talk to my fellow activists and get us to see it's all part of the same system, and we need to really address that underlying paradigm if we're going to make change.
So tell me what your next steps are. Where do you take the work you're doing now?
Well, just last night at 3 o'clock in the morning, I finished the Story of Seth book, I'm happy to say, which is going to be published by Free Press next March 9th. And so I'm going to be doing a book tour around the country. I hope to meet a lot of people at those events. And it's going to be on sale at local bookstores nationally after March. I'm also working with a bunch of different partner organizations to make additional films. The Story of Stuff website is continuing to get 10,000 views a day with us doing no media outreach. And originally it was just a static website. And so finally we thought, geez, if everyone's going to keep coming here and looking at this, let's make it an evolving source of information. So over the next year, we're planning to roll out a number of additional films that look at specific pieces of the materials economy and that are very solutions-oriented. So we're going to do a story of bottled water and a story of electronics. We're looking also at things like a story of coal, a story of carbon trading. We're going to do critical pieces that are very, very solutions-oriented about all different places along the materials economy that can help encourage people to plug into action.
So this is amazing how this has exploded beyond anybody's wildest imagination. Your film.
Oh, my God, that is so true. I remember when we were making the films, one of my colleagues said, you know, Annie, you might need someone to help you handle this once it's out. And I was like, handle what? It's a 20-minute cartoon. What's there to do? And that was wrong.
So tell me a little bit about, tell our listeners about Annie Leonard, where you come from, how you got so involved, and what was your trajectory into the world you're in.
There's a couple things that really influenced me and made me so obsessed with garbage and finding another way. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest in a very environmentally oriented family and spent a lot of time in the forest of the North Cascades Mountains growing up. And, and as a kid, I didn't know about carbon sequestration and hydrological cycles and all that, but I knew that it felt really good in my gut to be in the forest. It just felt grounded and good, and I loved the forest. And I decided to be a forest activist. I then went off to college in New York City, which was a dumb place to go to be a forest activist, but it turned out to be really fortuitous because I became obsessed with the piles of garbage along the street. My dorm was on 110th Street, and my campus was on 116th Street in Upper Manhattan, and I would walk those 6 blocks every day and just stare. I was mesmerized at these shoulder-high piles of garbage bags that lined the street, and I just kept wondering, what is in there? That's when I realized that they make garbage bags black for a reason. They don't want you looking. But then every day after class, I would come home, and the stuff was gone. So I was like, where did it go? I just became so curious. So I started poking in the bags, and what I saw was that it was almost all paper. And I said, my God, that's where my beloved forests are going. So I said, well, where is it going afterwards? So I took a field trip as a college student out to the Fresh Kills landfill in New York, and it was like a bolt of lightning hitting me in terms of my life's purpose. I stood there on Staten Island and looked out over just endless, as far as I could see, endless landscapes of trash, of couches and appliances and books and shoes and banana peels and pizza, and just like all of this incredible bounty that the earth had provided us turned into trash. And I thought, what kind of society have we made that is based on this just rush, like speed-driven trashing of the resources the planet provides into garbage, and how come it's hidden so out of view? So I decided to figure it out. And I was really lucky to get a job at Greenpeace after that, and I spent a decade working on international issues of waste, and that's how I was able to go to so many countries and see firsthand the factories where our stuff is made and the dumps where our stuff is dumped. And just my knowledge was so solid from seeing the communities that hosted these facilities in places like Bhopal or in the sweatshops in Haiti, from getting to know the workers and the community members, and then from coming home and seeing how all this manic consumption isn't even making us happy anyway. So why are we doing this?
So, and then the Story of Stuff took you in this new direction that created this kind of world that overwhelmed you and is pushing you along at the moment.
Yeah, it's funny. The Story of Stuff has made me sort of a more recognized spokesperson, but I've been working on these issues for 20 years. My friend Van Jones told me that one of the good things about being marginalized for 20 years is that by the time people are ready to listen, you get really good at saying what you have to say. So that's how I feel. There was, you know, I've been saying this stuff for 20 years, but I just didn't have such cute stick figures, so nobody paid attention till now.
Well, the stick figures have caused a revolution, which is just amazing.
They're awfully cute.
What it's done. So you have a an optimistic outlook on where this is all going?
More than optimistic. I am absolutely confident that things are going to change. I mean, as I said before, it's inevitable that things are going to change. And I think that people are basically smart and competent and good, and that as more of us wake up to the reality of what's happening, which is increasingly hard to ignore, we're going to do the right thing, and we're going to turn things around, and we're going to create a sustainable and just and joyful planet. I am absolutely confident of this.
And just one final thing or two here. What you just said, this kind of, and you do have a very exuberant, positive look at where we could go to change the world we're in and to create a different existence. But when you have that and see all these groups around the world that are affected by things like Story of Stuff and other things other people have done, that there are, as Paul Hawken likes to talk about, there are hundreds of thousands of groups around the world in small little places doing lots of incredible things. But then you have the U.S. Congress and our government and the immense corporate influence and power, corporate power that influences our government and really kind of controls the wheels of government in many ways. They can't get health care done. They're not going to put together a banking bill that protects the citizens. They're talking about the climate change bill is going to be not what it's supposed to be, and the resistance to changing that, and Congress not being able to change things. So I'd like to hear your thoughts juxtaposing those two things, the larger political reality that we face and this world that people like you and Paul Hawkins and the rest of us talk about.
Paul Hawkins said another beautiful thing related to that. He said, if you look at the data about the environmental trends right now and you aren't scared, you don't know how to read data.
Yeah, right.
He said at the same time, if you look at all of the groups working so hard to promote environmental sustainability and social justice and you don't feel hope, he said, then you haven't got a pulse. I mean, everywhere I go, I'm traveling all over the United States and internationally. Everywhere I go, there are people saying enough. There are people standing up and fighting back. And there are more of us than there are of them. Now, getting corporations out of politics would be an enormously useful first step. But I think these things are related. I've come to see that in all of our identity, we have two different parts of ourselves. We have a consumer self and a citizen self. And that consumer self is spoken to and validated and nurtured from day one. So, like, that muscle is really well developed. We all know how to be consumers. We know how to get online right now and get any product from anywhere in the world delivered to our door in 48 hours. Like, we know how to do that, and it's familiar. And one of the things about familiarity is it can lull us into staying there. So we stay in this consumer realm. Meanwhile, the citizen part of ourselves, our citizen muscle, has atrophied. And I really see this when I show the Story of Stuff live at public events. Almost always somebody will raise their hand and say, what can I buy differently to solve this problem?
Uh-huh.
And
right.
I tell them, you know what, actually you can't, because the solutions that we need are not for sale, even at Whole Foods. And so what we really need to do is come together, re-engage that citizen muscle, come together as community members and citizens. And I really believe that is more fun and more fulfilling than being stuck in that consumer realm. And so what I encourage people to do is just start doing anything. Just start getting involved with people. Start having potluck dinners. Start having discussions about what you want to change in your community. As people begin to extract themselves from this real consumer mania lifestyle and re-engage as citizens in an act of democracy, it's going to be more fun, and we're going to be rebuilding the power to take back our government so that it really can make the kind of changes we need on climate change and so many other issues. So I think we'll do it.
Story of Stuff. Annie Leonard, go to our website and check this out, steinarshow.org, and we have our link to Story of Stuff, or just go there by yourself. And Annie Leonard, it's been just a pleasure to finally make your acquaintance.
Thank you so much. Well, I look forward to talking to you again.
We will.